Please welcome in our new sponsor, Underdog Fantasy. Go to underdogfantasy.com and you'll discover that Underdog Fantasy is the best and easiest place to play fantasy sports. Underdog Fantasy lets you draft a fantasy dream team in minutes. Sign up now with the code POWERTRIP and you'll double your first deposit up to $100 in bonus cash when you make your first deposit of $10 or more. That's right, deposit $100 and get $100 for free. Underdog keeps it simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. Pick between 2 and 5 players to fill out your pick'em slip, get every pick right, and take home some cold, hard cash. Use that promo code POWERTRIP and get your first deposit doubled up by $100 by Underdog. That's underdogfantasy.com. Use the promo code POWERTRIP today.
The upcoming presentation is a two-man power trip of wrestling podcast production.
And now for something completely different.
Hey, I'm a Hall of Famer. I'm in 3 Halls of Fame. For the young fans, they don't give a damn. They just give a damn about themselves and what they're hearing now. And I got no problem with those rules. I know the rules going in. I'm happy to play the game that way.
And when Ivan came off with that knee drop from the top rope and he pinned me, I thought that something happened. I couldn't hear a thing. You could have heard a pin drop in that arena. It touched me so deeply that when I went in the dressing room, I really felt depressed.
I'll tell you that, I'll tell you right to his face. And with Hogan and I, if he wanted to get in a real street fight with me, trust me, he would lose. And he knew it.
You know, that's the other thing. They give you the belt, and they're like, okay, you're in charge of me. I was like, what?
When you mentioned a guy like Harley Race, that kind of legendary status, it's obvious why people would get upset.
As far as I'm concerned, Roddy Piper was not a wrestler. He wasn't even a good worker. If he had to go out and work his way to the top and not have good friends like Jim Barnett. I mean, I'm not saying he's not a good guy. He's just not a tough guy.
Bro, I swear to you, I don't have an ego. Like, I don't give a crap. That stuff is not important to me. People don't know me. They have no idea of who I am. They know of me as being a fictional character that they saw on TV.
People didn't understand that, you know, the guy they saw in the ring that happened to be using his real name and happened to actually be the president of the company, they really believed that that guy that they loved to hate was actually a pretty decent guy. And I think many people have the perception that I really was that character.
And welcome to the two-man power trip of wrestling. My host, JP John Paz, with me today, very special guest, author of the new Macho Man book, The Unbelievable Untamed Life of Randy Macho Man Savage. He is Mr. John Finkel. John, welcome in. How you doing?
I am awesome. Thank you for having me.
What is going on in your world and what's going on with this new book?
It is macho wall to wall, you know, all day, every day now leading to launch of WrestleMania week. It is the moment you know, I've been waiting for from the minute I decided to embark on the Macho Man journey all the way till now.
I love that. What about Macho Man? I kind of drew you to him. I mean, I'm a huge Macho Man, Randy Savage fan myself, but what kind of drew you to the Macho Man?
I grew up in like that perfect 80s golden era, you know, the Hogan era. I know you're into that. Was exactly yep. my wheelhouse. I think I was 7 or 8, you know, when Macho first came on the scene, and then probably that age when he won, you know, when he was like Intercontinental Champion and then lost to Steamboat at WrestleMania. And like, I was all in at that time, meaning I believed all of it. I believed everything that was happening. My dad did a great job of kind of not, you know, almost like Santa Claus, like not really telling me until I kind of had some weird questions when I was probably like 10 or 11. I'm like, why does this keep happening? Or this makes no sense. Or I even remember when Macho finally got the belt, it was like the convoluted tournament with like, well, wait a minute. Why would Gene Tunney, like, who is this guy? I don't even know who this guy is. Like, why is he making these moves to like make it hard for Macho and Hogan? So just the, like everybody else, the millions of us who grew up then, just the voice and the charisma and like the craziness. He was just so unlike, you know, anyone else. Hogan had the size and the booming voice and the, you know, the patriotic thing and the song and the brother and all of that. But like, I was just more drawn to Macho. And it was like that era for me, I was everything. I called myself Little John Studd, you know, after Big John Studd. And I was just in it. I had all the action figures, lunchboxes, the cartoons, like whatever it was and whatever it still is. My son's 11 now and is all in on this generation. So I'm watching it happen to him. It's just, it's awesome. And it attracts a certain kind of dude. And I guess I'm one of those dudes. And so are you.
Absolutely. Love that era. I was all in on all of it. Before we get to the book, though, something that I always think about with that era, obviously you mentioned the convoluted tournament at WrestleMania 4 and that no good Jack Tunney, brother, him winning the title then. But Hogan obviously is the big star of the era. But when Savage wins the title, he's champion for a year. There's no drop off. He maintains that level of popularity. So Macho mm-hmm. was a huge draw, too.
Yeah, I did a lot of research. And what's beautiful now, it'd be a little harder. I think the way they do things with the Nielsen ratings and all that. But back then, knee deep in the newspaper archives, this stuff's all printed. There's no manipulating numbers. There was nobody analyzed box office. It was just like, here's the numbers for the Saturday Night Main Event, and here's the numbers for this and that. And so at that era, right after, you know, that whole situation happened and Hogan kind of disappeared for a little bit, when Macho was on top, there were still many, many nights where WrestleMania, after WrestleMania, the basking of that, and then all the weekly events, you know, it was like back then it was a different time. So football was always, you know, still pretty good on top, you know, from a mainstream sports perspective. Baseball, you know, it was pretty well known for the playoffs and the World Series, but wrestling was above hockey. Wrestling was above basketball. Wrestling was above tennis and golf. Like, it's hard to fathom now just because of streaming and there's so many options and there's UFC and there's all these things. But from a general viewership and audience perspective, there was no drop off in attendance. There was no drop off in TV ratings. And there were people inside who were kind of happy to have a new guy on top. And Macho, I mean, that was the moment he'd waited for his whole entire life.
It is amazing to look at that because obviously years later, not to say anything bad about the Warrior, but he didn't draw as well. And then you look at Savage and you're like, wow, Savage drew a lot better than Warrior. Obviously Hogan was the big draw, but there was no drop off, which is amazing. Yeah. So it's just like, wow. So Savage was kind of like the 1A to Hogan's one. If you want to say mega powers, neck and neck.
And he was a worker too. The issue that I think maybe Warrior and some of the other guys had was the in-between days, right? The in-between, even the house show days, Macho came up as, you know, people who are diehard fans of his know, but even, you know, the book I wrote was for much more for, you know, it goes into everything, but there's a lot of stuff I didn't know. I'm not one of those, you know, guys who just knows everything about the territories and knew all the stuff about Lawler and all those things. But Macho comes from the era of 2 or 3 shows a night, cramming in a car, driving overnight to the next town, you know, in the Midwest from Decatur to Des Plaines to, you know, all over everywhere, you know, 5 shows in 3 days in Lexington. And so he was a worker. So when he got the belt, it was like, and I found TV interviews and old radio interviews where he was pumping up shows in, you know, random spots all over the country. He was doing the radio hit in the morning and the lunchtime radio hit and the night radio hit and then going to the hospital charity thing and then going to do the store opening and then doing the wrestling the night before, promoting it, flying on a plane overnight. he was all like all in on being the face of the WWF at the time. And, you know, he was ready to work. He was ready to do it 6-7 nights a week if he had to. And I think some of the other guys just maybe didn't have that. And Hogan certainly had kind of worn out a little bit and then came back and was able to do, you know, he was the ratings draw, the golden goose for a decade, 2 decades almost. But Macho was like, would not be outworked, would not be out hustled, and was willing to take all the dates and more that Hogan had to, you know, to keep growing the brand.
Now with this book, tell us just like kind of where you start. Do you start all the way from the beginning? I mean, are you going all the way back?
I start with Angelo. Yeah. I mean, the only way to really tell the story of Randy Savage is to tell the story of Randy Poffo, which is to tell the story of Angelo Poffo. And Angelo is just an absolutely fascinating human being. I do books on people who are one of ones. That's all the biographies I've done. All the books I've done are unique things and unique people. And when I started, one of the reasons I knew Macho would be a special book is because he comes from a really special, not only wrestling family, just an entertainment family. I mean, Angelo Poffo broke the world sit-up record when he was, you know, in the Navy. And then he goes on and starts his career wrestling with Vern Gagne and some of these guys who were, you know, the I don't know, really like the Seth Rollins-ish of their day before there was this massive, you know, national thing in the territories. They were pretty famous guys. They sold out some pretty big arenas. He worked for Gorgeous George, who sold out Madison Square Garden and made millions at a time when, you know, there was no way to sell pay-per-views. You just went to an arena on your name and were able to draw crowds. And so he set the stage for someone like Macho. But, you know, when you start there, the thing is you start with Angelo and wrestling, and then you take a hard right turn to baseball for 20 years. Because that was Randy's first obsession, and had he not broken his collarbone or not maybe had a couple hits or miss here and there, we might never heard of Randy Savage. We may have heard of, you know, Randy Poffo, the 270 hitter for 3 years with the Cincinnati Reds, you know.
Right. Now, is that true with him teaching himself how to throw lefty because he broke that collarbone?
Yeah, there are a bunch of – I talked to a lot of I talked to almost all of his high school teammates on from Downers Grove. I talked to a ton of his minor league teammates, coaches, and that is true. He for those who don't know, who are listening, he shattered his like collarbone basically, or separated his shoulder, kind of fractured his collarbone at a collision at home plate when he was actually playing very, very well. And for most guys, he was hanging on to Double A. He was not, you know, he had made like the Single A All-Stars his first year. He led the team in home runs, but it was like 12 home runs. It wasn't anything crazy, but he was good. People noticed his hustle. They noticed he could swing the bat. He wasn't exceptionally fast. He was trying to be a catcher. Anyway, as he's one of those middle rung guys trying to hang on to his career, he didn't even get drafted. He walked on and kind of made a tryout. He broke his collarbone, which is, you know, death basically for a catcher. You can't throw to first and you're not hitting, you know, 4 zillion home runs. And so he was kind of bummed out that night and then had this epiphany in the great like Macho way that we know, basically said like, I have two arms, I'll just use the other one. And for the next 3 months, the myth has it, and a couple guys confirmed, he got up, took a bucket of, you know, 500 baseballs to a grocery store down the road in Sarasota, and just threw 1,500 balls lefty against the wall over and over and over again until he could throw a passable ball. And it sounds crazy. You're an athlete. I'm an athlete. So I took my son out when I was researching, and I was like, I took a glove and a bunch of balls. I was like, let me throw 50. And I'm going to tell you, it's hard as hell, man. Like, to get any kind of pace and accuracy when you've thrown righty your whole life, especially at that era, is very, very difficult. So I would imagine he had a lot of shoulder pain, a lot of shoulder issues. But by the end of those 3 months, he ended up getting back into, you know, the minors, and he was able to throw, you know, a ball from catcher to first, or from first to third if he tried to switch to be first baseman, which is like one of the most insane things. I mean, you don't hear that even attempting it. It just seems like, well, we don't do that as athletes, and he did it.
Yeah, like what dedication and pride. Like, man, talk about levels of dedication. That's like above and beyond.
Yeah,
and obviously he obviously gets that from his dad, who did the world record in sit-ups.
Yep. Yeah, the intensity there for both of those guys, and the focus is incredible. And that was why when I was, you know, you can't really research totally chronologically, because interviews come in at random times. You kind of just, as you do one interview, they tell you to talk to this guy or this person, and then you read another article and you think, oh, I really got to talk to this person. So it kind of ends up being scattershot. But the way I really, for me, it really helped crystallize the story is because as I'm, you know, maybe talking to Hacksaw Jim Duggan or something about why he's intense before a match, or learning about his pre-match, you know, stuff with, you know, whatever, George the Animal Steel or whoever it is. It's the same guy who was 22 trying to make it to the pros, you know, doing 1,000 sit-ups every morning to get his core strong. Or even in high school, he used to bring his bat bag from class to class, and he'd bring a weighted baseball to squeeze to keep his forearm strong. It's the same person, right? The character becomes a whole new thing, and the charisma and all that. But it really helps people understand, I think, when they read the book, by the time you get to the wrestling part, you're so familiar with who he is and what makes him tick from having seen the end result, that none of it surprises you, even though it's coming from a clean-shaven, humble, mild-mannered guy, not, you know, the macho man that we know.
I love going from like Randy Poffo to the Randy Savage, because without that, without him becoming Randy Macho Man Savage, we don't get one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. To me, the perfect wrestler, to me, if you were actually going to sculpt out the perfect wrestler, because Hogan is great, and obviously I think he's a god, and it's one of the all-time greats, no doubt about it. But Savage, to me, he's a better wrestler, better worker. So you got to throw that into the mix, too. So I feel like he's more perfect as far as wrestling, because he has the look, he has the charisma, he has the voice, he has the talking ability, he has the work. Like, he has everything you want in a professional wrestler, like the old Bret Hart scale. He's 30 out of 30, or, you know, however you want to say. I feel like Savage is the perfect wrestler, right?
I agree. And you know, the thing that I realized as I relived all this stuff, which was the coolest part about writing the book, like, I obviously stayed up on Savage, but he's been dead a long time now, and you see the memes and the YouTube videos and some great accounts that, you know, share stuff on this date, this happened or that happened, but I got to relive his career chronologically. So, you know, we have with the Peacock, you can stream all the WrestleManias and all the, you know, a lot of the old pay-per-views. And then with that and YouTube and a couple other things, you can pretty much start from his, you know, when he picked his manager and Piper's Pit, the first appearance, to when he picked Elizabeth. Like, you can kind of, if you order it right, and I did this with my son, which is awesome, because now he's like this massive Macho Man guy, you can just go through and see how he evolved all the way up and through, you know, the Macho Man character. And when you do that, you realize he is like the $6 million man of wrestling. Like, not only does he have the he cuts, you know, the best, and Hulk, you have to give him credit. Like, it's easy sometimes to pile on Hulk now, but like, his promos were awesome. The intensity and the Mean Gene, like, he was great. I actually found a little bit of amazingly, as I was also a huge Hulk fan, a little bit more respect for the vintage Hulk, not like late 90s and all the Hollywood Hogan and all that. But he really was, you couldn't take your eyes off Hulk in those maybe whatever, like WrestleMania 1 to 7 or 8. He had it. But Randy was a far better athlete. I mean, Hulk wasn't an athlete. He was a musician. He was in a band. He's a big, giant dude, 6'6 in high school. But he wasn't like a basketball player or a football player. Like, you know, even Hacksaw was a football player. Like, most of these guys, you know, Tito, same thing, is that football player. They all went to that school in Texas. Like, but I don't believe any of them athletically, other than Steamboat. Steamboat was really athletic. That's why that match was so perfect. But I think Macho for that era was the best athlete, the highest jumper. If there was a combine of wrestling things like they do at the NFL, I believe he would score the highest, like you had said. You know, some of the guys, you know, Shawn Michaels, who came later, and Bret Hart, and even The Rock with his football background has, you know, some of that stuff. But Macho was not a giant. You know, he was, you know, varied from talking to people, you know, with his walking on his tiptoes, and he didn't stand flat-footed because of this. But he was like 6'1", generously, and he always, you know, always said 240, which, you know, we'll give him, but he probably was closer to 220, 225, you know, which again is, when you talked earlier about like the evolution, that was one thing that I didn't really appreciate, just because, you know, when I grew up, when he first showed up on my TV screen, that was the first time I saw him. He's already Macho Man. But when he left baseball, he was, you know, 6'1", 180. He had built a really sinewy baseball body. And it took him a couple of years of just gorging himself and lifting and meatheading and some steroids and some other things to put on 45 pounds of muscle. You know, fortunately, the Poffo frame can do it. Angelo was, you know, wrestled around 220, 230. And Lanny, you know, went right into wrestling and was 6'2", 240 like overnight. But it took Randy a long time to get there.
When you look at Macho Man, just like we said, like, kind of the perfect guy built for the wrestling business, and it seems like his charisma and everything else, it just made everybody kind of attracted to him, and just the way he was. When he gets to WWF, you know, obviously where we both saw him first, and when he really gained all that popularity, do you think it was one of those things where it's like, man, this guy, he's such a good, heel, but I don't know. Maybe he's a better babyface. What do you think? Because he made so much money as a heel, but he was so over as a babyface.
Well, the funny thing is, in the very beginning, the whole reason he had Miss Elizabeth was to make people not like him. Like, he was the counterweight to Hogan. They were missing that 1A evil, you know, heel, bad guy. And so Macho was immensely popular, but had been used to playing the heel in, you know, Kentucky against Jerry Lawler. That was his whole thing for 3 or 4 years. He carried an entire, you know, renegade outlaw company going against the biggest babyface in, you know, Lexington, Kentucky, that whole area, which was Jerry Lawler. So he fit that bill. And when he finally got, you know, called up to New York, as they say, it was very much to be the, you know, do that with Hogan over time. But he was so good that they needed Elizabeth there to mistreat her. I mean, what's funny is if you do go back and watch some of the early interviews that the Piper's Pit and he's on Vince McMahon's show and the Tuesday Night Wrestling and all these things from back in the day, he's such a jerk to her. Like, he really is playing. And it's even funnier when you realize as an adult they were married and they clearly had, you know, they were together for every minute of every day. And then they'd go on camera and he would just be an ass, you know, like full out, and then come off camera. And I'm sure they had some transitioning issues from being like that character to, you know, a husband or whatever. But the heel turn from the beginning was totally calculated and made total sense. And then he just was so captivating. And, you know, he started out with the freak out. That was like his first phrase. And then the ooh yeah. But then his promos were so good and we wanted more of him. And you know how it goes with all these guys. Like, eventually popularity trumps whether you're good or bad. And that's when they, you know, they put him over. And then even they tried with, you know, when they tried with Steamboat, that was huge. Like, Steamboat was the biggest baby face, even more so than Hogan. Like, there were times where I was doing research where they thought of trying to get Steamboat. Maybe we have him turn and he's like, no one will buy it. Like, that's never going to happen. And so we look back now and we're like, that match was amazing. But I even found myself even researching, like, but Macho lost that and we wanted him to lose that at the time. Yeah. Because he hurt our guy. He broke the larynx, you know, shattered his larynx, which I believe, like I said, that was the thing was like it's so fun to watch it now because I can go back to my mindset then. And I believed that Randy Savage broke his larynx with the bell. And like, how does he do that? How does he treat Elizabeth so bad? Like, take him down, Ricky, you know?
Yep. But when he turns into mega powers, oh man, that was just
brain explodes.
Yeah. Yep. He is so good though. Cause I remember I talked to Jerry Jarrett, this is years ago, obviously before he had passed. He was saying that Lawler and him hated Savage because, you know, he's trying to invade their company. He's trying to make money off their company. But then when it came around time when it's like, okay, that company ICW doesn't exist anymore, should we bring him in? They both were like, yes, right? I mean, they both were like, he is so good. He's so money. And then, you know, Jarrett's like, are you sure you want to work with this guy? You trust this guy? He's like, I don't care. He's going to make us so much money.
Randy was a lot of things. And in that era, he was just out of control, frankly. I mean, they would storm their shows. They would start fight with the fans. They would call him. They would call out Lawler endlessly. They went to his house when they knew he wasn't there. And I mean, there was a lot of stories. Rip Rogers tells a lot of stories. And I talked to George Weingroff and all these guys. They were out of control. I mean, they were a bunch of 25-year-old meatheads trying to make a name for themselves. Angelo's business sense at that point, who, you know, ran the whole thing, was not very savvy. They were spending money on the wrong things. They had bad airtime, bad studio time. They got basically booted from Rupp Arena, which was the Golden Goose. Like, if you can't perform there, especially in the territory, you cannot. That was it. They, you know, Lawler sold out once a month. I think it was every third Thursday or some schedule. And that kept the money afloat between all the houses. It was steady money. It was more of a salary. And they got kicked out for some of their antics and some of their stuff. And so when they finally, you know, when Lawler's company finally broke ICW's back, they were done. Randy was like selling vitamins. Like, he was a phone vitamin salesman. Like, they blew it. And after a little introspection, Randy reached out to Jerry and wrote a letter, which, like, I think Jerry still, he had it before he passed. He read it on a few, you know, occasions where it was like, I'm sorry. Like, I went about business the wrong way. I have spent all this time building this character. We have all this heat built up with no, we never actually did anything.
Yep.
Well, we could do a loser leaves town type thing, and then we could figure it out from there. But I promise you, if you bring me in the fold, I will be on business. I will continue all the things that have made our rivalry great. But on the business sense, I will be on the up and up. And when they brought it to Lawler, he was like, we can make so much freaking money. Like, we have to do this, you know? And they did. They sold out. I mean, it was like for, I can't remember exactly how long it was, 9 months or a year till he finally moved up. But it was like they were just money hand over fist at that time. Everywhere they went, they sold out.
Man, it's just funny to look at Savage and be like, he just prints money. Like, Lawler, how could you not bring him in sooner? But obviously, everything was working against that happening because of what Savage did to him business-wise, or what he was trying to do to
him.
Yeah,
and they were definitely, and there was lawsuits. I mean, they were suing the territories. They were suing all of them as for, like, a monopoly. And, like, they were suing Rupp Arena. For, I mean, they were really being litigious, and they had no legs to stand on. They had no money. They had, you know, they had an old, I remember in one of the court things I found, or write-ups of, like, their lawsuit, they were listing their assets, and they had like an old van, like 10-year-old used editing equipment. I mean, Liz, who was barely dating Randy at the time, was doing the VO for some of their, you know, local shows. They had a ring that they had to assemble and disassemble that had dead spots and boards that was, you know, destroying these guys. They're staying 6-7 dudes in one motel, sleeping in their car. I mean, it was not a pleasant life at all, and they loved it. But a lot of them, even in the book I mentioned, really kind of believed that Angelo was just didn't understand the larger picture, and they should have been doing business or even merged longer before that with Lawler and had their stables do everything they were doing just with the same goal. They were trying to, like, they believed they could just take out and take over Lawler, and that it just wasn't going to happen. I mean, and then there was no reason for it. If they did, then what? Then who do you wrestle? Like, it made no long-term sense. And so that's kind of why ultimately they went out, and then, you know, Savage did what he did.
Man, it's like the original Invasion angle, except for the one company wasn't in on it. You know,
that's right. It was all great. Like, yeah. When you look back on it and you read about it, and you even listen to some of the podcasts, a lot of those guys, not now, but maybe in like 2010 to 2020, especially when Randy died, they all came out and talked about this stuff. And I interviewed maybe 10 or 12 guys who were in the ICW and tried out and all this stuff. It was like everything was exactly as it should have been from a drawing heat perspective, and even from a program. It couldn't have gone better if they had actually sat down and marketed it like this, but they just were two different companies, so they couldn't capitalize on any of it. They couldn't plan it appropriately, and that was where they just didn't see the forest for the trees a little bit.
With Macho, obviously one of the most popular guys ever, Slim Jim, which he still technically is the sponsor, yeah, the spokesman for them today. Isn't that crazy, though? He's like the most perfect guy for the campaign. Step into it. Need a little excitement? Like, he's the perfect guy for Slim Jim.
Well, it was funny. The story before that is, so we all know him from Slim Jim, but in the year he took over from Hogan, Mountain Dew just did one of their first like big collaborations with the WWF. And they made Savage like the face of Mountain Dew because Hogan was gone, and they were doing this big promotion called the Dew Slam of the Night, and they wanted someone edgy for that audience. And so for a year, which we don't remember because we were like 9, he was out doing promos like he does for Slim Jim for Mountain Dew, and he was going to win Slam of the Night every time. And then it was a few years later where he became the official guy for Slim Jim. But at first they gave it to Warrior, which didn't take. And then they wanted Sam Kinison, which also didn't take. And from what I found research wise, it was like when they finally got Randy again, his obsessive compulsive craziness. He approached the commercial shoot like he would approach WrestleMania. Not that this was some side thing, but that like people were paying him to do a job, and he was going to do Randy on 10, and it was perfect.
He is the perfect guy. And even after that, I know they tried some wrestlers and different people here and there.
Yeah.
But he was the perfect guy. And even they're like, all right, let's go back to him because he's, you know, 2024. He's still technically a spokesman.
Yeah, they got my guy LA Knight involved, thankfully. So I'm very happy about that. We're Finkel household, the big LA Knight guys. So I like that he's got it. He was one of the few guys, I think, now who holds that level of charisma. You know, not that Randy yet, but like he's in that ballpark of the catchphrases and the, you know, all that stuff. So I'm glad he's the one maybe to take the mantle, and I think Bianca Belair does it too. She's great. So it's really cool when you see that happen now. Even now, for my son, like we'll be driving somewhere and you go to a gas station and there's the Randy Savage holder for the Slim Jims, and it's like that was huge for his legacy. I mean, if that didn't happen and he just kind of finished up, and then he had the WCW years, which was more of I say it in the respectful way, but more of a diehard wrestling fan audience. It was just a little bit, it was just smaller. It was as intense and cool, and the angles were cool, and the Wolfpack and all that stuff was great. But it was just smaller, not nearly as many people when he was there. Later, obviously, with the late mid-90s when it was really rivaling Monday Night Raw and all that. But that first couple years there, from a mainstream perspective, for a lot of people, because we were also aging out a little bit. When we were getting into high school, for a lot of those millions of us, plus or minus 4 or 5 years of 93, 94, 95, once he left WWE, he kind of left our lives other than Slim Jim. So he never left in that respect,
When you are putting the book together, is WCW a big part of it, or is mostly focusing on like WWF run?
No, they're a big part of it. That transition out, what it meant to him, that actual break from Vince and from leaving the company, and then what he was going to do, the time in the booth to when he left, to his return to WCW. Yeah, we go into all that. I don't spend nearly as much time on the later years, the years where he's, I have a chapter titled Dark Macho, where it's like, because that really is the period where, unless you are, again, there's a percentage of wrestling fans who watch every single thing all the time, and this book should satisfy them in a lot of ways. But when he coming out with Medusa and all the, the three, even Lanny even said it best, by that time, his body was beat. He had the dark hair, the ponytail.
Yep.
He was just, Lanny's quote was he surrounded himself with gimmickry because he was old and couldn't really perform. And for those of us who every now and then would see him on TV like that, it was like a who is this old man shouting type moment. He had it. And fortunately, towards the very end of his career, he sort of positioned himself back, and it looked like there may have been some reconciliation there. So I spent as much time on it as I felt necessary to keep the story moving. But there were so many matches at that point once he left WWF where I tried to keep the highlights in, what it meant to where he was going, how it led to, the rap album and Bonesaw McGraw and all that stuff.
It is crazy to look at it. Like Vince almost in 94 sees him as like an ambassador of the company, taking him out of the ring, but he could still go. He could still wrestle. Obviously he wrestled until, about 2000 or so with WCW, and he still had a lot of legs, obviously, because WCW overtook WWF partly with his help, obviously Hogan and NWO, but partly with his help. So is that like a bitter point of contention with him and Vince? Like, hey, I'm not done. I could still wrestle. How come I'm not wrestling Shawn Michaels and Bret all the time?
Yeah, that was the main issue. Well, he had that famous planned match that he wanted. He had planned his exit of WWF. I think that's where the big bitterness came from. He after SummerSlam and his personal life was just, a mess, right? So he did take time off from wrestling, which was much needed. He did a ton of charity. He was a big, big philanthropy guy. Anything with kids, he basically said yes to his whole career. And he became, like you said, the ambassador, the announcer, which I think early on, just from having rewatched again, I don't pretend I've watched all that stuff back when I was in high school. I was playing sport. I wasn't like every night watching everything, but rewatching a lot of it. He settled into it pretty well, actually. He really eventually, he was good calling the matches and bringing the energy and all that. But once he healed and once the Elizabeth thing was sort of past him, he's watching Hogan and these other guys, kill it in the WCW when all these newer young guys are coming up in the WWE that Vince wants to focus on. And he had this planned match, Lanny told me, of, he wanted to go out with some kind of one year to 18-month program with Shawn Michaels, finish losing either the title or just, one of those big, WrestleMania co-headline type things. And then he would ride off into the sunset and do everything. And I think when Vince didn't let him and called him old and they did that, Nacho Man skit and all those kind of things, it hurt. He had a big, big ego and he felt like he was on the top of his game and that he really wasn't given the chance to really explore the title time. Once he had the belt, it was very short considering his popularity. It's kind of nuts when you look back. That's all they did with him. they have Hogan and they have Macho. And I was thinking, because we watch it now, I was talking to my son months ago. We were watching, trying to figure out the Cody Roman thing and all that. And I'm like, whatever you say, yes or no, they're milking it for what it's worth. They didn't just let it be a year and then he gets a title and all that. And I remember we were talking. He's like, well, how come, there was no part three, because he watched all the Mega Powers and the exploding and all of that. And I was like, they had an angle sitting there, possibly, which I think would have been amazing, of they do all this stuff. They can still do the Mega Powers exploding or whatever, but then they could have all the sympathy somehow, goes to Macho if they wanted. They could have had Elizabeth go to Hogan. Macho becomes this, sympathetic giant baby face. Hogan, they had this whole, they never played the Hogan jealous of Macho angle. And they could have. I believe that having watched all this in hindsight, and who knows, maybe they kicked around Hogan said no or Macho said no. But I think they had a year left of Hogan champion, you know, Hogan champion, then Macho actually beats him. And Hogan has this like existential crisis for like 6 months to 9 months or a year between whatever, SummerSlam and WrestleMania, one of those two. And Macho like carries it on. And then he loses the belt, but wins back Elizabeth. There's a whole, in my head, I would have done some things different.
Yeah. You would have went somewhere differently creative.
Well, because it was so short. What they did was incredible. I mean, the whole Mega Powers thing was amazing. The Mega Powers exploding was amazing. That match was amazing. The Macho King with Sherry thing was great. It was a great turn. But I feel like they could have just done all of it and just they missed a year. They had these two guys, right? It's like, you know, you have one and one A. You have a two generational guys at the exact same time. And it was like, you know, Hogan was just so big. And I don't know, you know, I've talked to some of those guys and, you know, you're not going to go against the money, right? But Hogan had never, and he eventually did the Hollywood Hogan turn and all that, but they didn't explore an insecure Hogan would have been interesting for about 6 months to 9 months.
Yeah.
And they never did that.
It almost felt like Vince McMahon, was so dead set on like Warrior being the next guy. He kind of like pushed Savage off to the side. I know he was doing the Macho King stuff and he always had good feuds, but it was almost like, hey, what happened to Savage? You're kind of like pushing him off to the side. This is not right. This is not the right guy.
And they never had Macho beat Hogan pin, you know, like that. Yes. And you know, they say that, you know, I've heard it's all rumor and it's 20, 30 years, 40 years ago. Who knows? But I guess Hogan was just not going to let that happen. But again, maybe somebody else is like, no, he would have, but you know, these are all, you know, locker room stories from 40 years ago of what may or may not have happened, but they had mileage there, I think. And Warrior, you know, if you're asking me to list my guys, it's like Macho, Hogan, Warrior, you know, Macho's one, I have to put Hogan two just because of all the quotes and all the, you know, Hulkamania shirts and all that. But Warrior's three. I mean, he was, you know, for his little moment in the sun, like you couldn't beat the ropes and gorillas, like all of it. It's hard. It was great. It's just that there was an angle there. It all could have been just stretched out a little bit, I think.
I like Warrior, but man, him beating Hogan and Savage back-to-back at Mania, oof, that just didn't sit right. Especially WrestleMania 6. That just didn't sit right. But you know, then Savage retires him. It's like, oh.
Yeah, the funny thing is I had a moment watching that. That was the match where whoever loses retires. And I remember I was sitting with my son, and he'd kind of been doing the research with me and watching stuff, and he's like, they don't like retire, like he doesn't have to retire, right? And I laughed because I was like, I vividly remember watching this like on my parents' couch with maybe three friends drinking soda and eating Pizza Hut, discussing like, what's he going to do when he retires? Like, what if Warrior loses? Like, because we all wanted Macho, like, what does he do? Is he going to play football? Like, we didn't, you know, you're 10. It's like, this is real. This is like, you didn't know that it was all just a thing that they said and that there could be 50 retirement matches and they could come back 11 different ways. So what I try to do in the book is to really explain it as a journalist and adult writing about it, but I also take a lot of time to put you in the mindset of the reason this guy matters so much is because in that retirement match there were probably 6 to 12 million of us little dudes who were like, oh my god, one of our two favorite wrestlers is going to retire after this match, and that mattered.
Oh man, I just remember a kid, I was so upset because I wanted Macho Man to win. I know he's the bad guy or whatever, but I wanted him to win and he retired. I was like, oh my god, he's gone, we'll never
see him
ever again.
Ever again, right? He has to literally hang up his sunglasses and never step in the ring again. It's that serious. You know what else is funny too? I don't know the last time you watched that on YouTube or Googled it or whatever, but I was probably more because I was in the mindset of like, you know, Savage, where he was physically. But when you look at it now, pay attention to the size difference. Like,
yeah,
Macho looks like a child. Like Warrior was so big, he even outsized Hogan. You know, Hogan had already probably lost an inch or two from all the leg drops. He famously, like, and I did some research on it. He really was 6'7" and went down to like 6'5" because his spine kept getting compressed and compressed. But Warrior is equally, Macho never looked small in the ring with Hogan. I mean, he was smaller, but he never looked, there wasn't like, it didn't mess with your eyes. Warrior looks like he's beating up on someone's younger brother. I mean, it's that pronounced, and I couldn't watch it without thinking that he picks him up at one point and it's like I pick up my son. And Macho is 230 probably at that point in time. Warrior's 285, and Macho has a great quote in the build up to that. It was in a small town paper. They probably did a house show somewhere, it was in like Wisconsin or something, and somebody asked him about, you know, how you feel about going up against Warrior, And he's just like, well, you know, I didn't know they built people that big. Like, he's like, he goes almost 300 pounds and he's faster than me. And he was being, you know, Macho really, I think most of the time just answered questions as he would answer questions, if he would build up hype or not. And I was reading that interview thinking, like, I bet you that was just a real answer. Like, you never know, but it's true. And, you know, he's like, I don't know, it's a mountain to climb, something like that. Like, he goes almost 300 pounds and is faster than me in the ring. I've never faced that before. And yeah, it's obviously, you know, staged, but he's right. This dude had 50 pounds on him and probably ran like a 4.5 40.
Warrior's crazy because he's probably 6'2 ish, but his frame, like, you know, just some guys, massive. Like, I don't know, for whatever he's seen, I feel like obviously it could be steroids or whatever, but his frame isn't as big. Warrior just had he had this huge frame and just it fit all those huge muscles, like, fit his body. It's like, wow, this guy's like, he's just a beast.
He had the ties that he did to pop his biceps was very, very smart. Yep. He would get so jacked up before he'd go out that he was already had that pump, which could give you a good inch or two on your arms. I know the other guys would bang out some push-ups or something, but Warrior, I found an old interview with him where he's like, he's kind of a bitter guy. This is at, you know, maybe 10 years after he retired, before he passed away. And he was like, I gave more in my entrance than half of these losers gave in the ring. Like, by the time I came out, he's like, I spent a half hour to an hour before you saw me getting into this character, the Warrior mindset, and banging my head against the wall, slapping my face, and working out to the point where I was almost at exhaustion. So when we saw him, when he would finally run out, he was like ready to explode, you know, pumped up beyond belief. Whereas some of the other guys, not they were coming out dry, they all had the baby oil and all that stuff, but they didn't just do a workout basically to get in that frame of mind. They kind of just, all right, you know, let's go. Not, all right, give me an hour to get ready, you know?
Right. Yep. You know, it's funny, like, after Savage retires too, I remember getting a Coliseum home video or something. It's like, Macho Man is contractually obligated to wrestle Rick Martel tonight or something. So he was like, oh, wait, so he's not gone. Oh, but then he's gone. But then the whole Jake the Snake Roberts thing and, you know, reinstate Macho Man, which is awesome that WWE just did a Rivals episode or whatever, documentary on A&E about it, because I love that feud. That was so good because that's, like, yes, we got Macho Man back. And you hate Jake the Snake Roberts because he's scared the living daylights out of you because he was so evil.
Well, then the wedding, you crashed the wedding with the snake in the box. Yep. So it all made sense to do. You know, Jake's hard for a book like this because he's in interviews. He said so many different things about the same things where you just can't, you know, it's not like you can be like, Jake the Snake Roberts said, because you could probably find a quote where he says something kind of different. So I kind of found the one that was the most truthful, that made the most sense for what they went with, at least, you know, whatever he said behind the scenes. And and it seems like they had, and Macho said it in an interview later in his career. He did a bunch of interviews when this when the rap album came out, where he actually was pretty candid about his wrestling career. And they thought they had a good feud with him and Jake. And I guess for the very beginning of it, in the house shows, not the snake bite big one, there just wasn't a pop there. It just didn't, for whatever reason. It didn't have that lift that they, you know, that we probably wouldn't even maybe recognize, but the guys in the ring kind of knew that curtain thing where, like, they're all looking to see, you know, all right, how did that go? And they just went away from it.
Such a great feud, though. I love it, though. Yeah. Jake slapping Liz, the snake bite.
I talked to Lanny about, like, the day before. Lanny has a great thing. And thankfully I talked to him before he passed away a lot. So I have sort of, the only people in the car were, you know, Lanny, Randy, and Liz, and the other two were passed away. So Lanny was telling me, he's like, I was doing the little brother, like, fake sleeping in the back. We were driving to the arena. We had a long ride after a flight. And Liz was like, you cannot get bit by a snake. Like, you shouldn't get bit. It's not good. Like, we don't know what kind of snake this is. You trust Jake, by the way? Like, what if he's wrong? And he said they would just had this huge blowout argument. And the end result of the argument, which Jake has told a million times in podcasts or whatever, but the end result of that argument was the snake bites you first in front of me thing. So that was where that came from. And Lanny was like, I was like, what did you say? He's like, I didn't say anything. It's like my older brother and my sister-in-law arguing. I just pretended I was sleeping. But that was where that all came from.
So good, because it just shows you how committed they are, but also how crazy those two are. Like, I'll get bit by a snake. Like, what? Are you crazy? What if it's not devenomized or whatever, you know?
Yeah, and Macho was funny because, like, you know, he was well-read. He wasn't like some bumpkin. He was an honor society guy. He was a great poker player, great chess player. Like, he was very smart, very cerebral about a lot of things. But he didn't trust anyone. at all. And, you know, he didn't, you know, he didn't fraternize other than he had some nice times with Hogan when they worked out together, and they, you know, they did hang out by all accounts a lot for two different periods of time. But other than that, and him and Hacksaw were close for a while and a couple other guys, but he wasn't like one of the boys where let's do whatever, we're all in. He was very much like, I need to know what's going to happen, Jake. Like, so you take the bite, I'll come back in an hour. If you're alive, we'll do it, you know, and that's kind of what they did.
I love the, you mentioned before, the Spider-Man bone saw. I love that because obviously that was one at the time. I think it wasn't the most popular movie in the world for years.
Yeah, right.
So awesome to get that mainstream attention again for, you know, a god of wrestling. Pretty
yeah,
cool.
He, you know, Lanny was telling me that he, you know, came kind of out of, not out of nowhere, but like he didn't have an agent. You know, Sam Raimi kind of wanted him there. And Macho was, you know, he had been far from wrestling. So they gave him like 6 months to grow his hair out and his beard out. And they had some, some extensions and stuff for his hair, but he had to grow the beard out and he had to put on like 20, 25 pounds of muscle. And that was, you know, everybody who saw him in that, when you first recognized it was him, I mean, who knows what concoction, you know, he was on. It was on a lot of things because he looked like he was about to pop. I was talking to Paul Roma for the book. And I at the end of him, I would always be like, all right, once you lost touch, like when was the last time did you see him again? Or, you know, a lot of the guys didn't because of the way Randy was. But he was like, actually, the next time I saw him, I was in the theater with my kids. And I was like, is that Randy? And he's like, I can't even. He's like, I know, you know, steroids and things, like from being around all these guys. I don't even know what he could have been on to get that look that he had. And so, but it was great for us to have like that nostalgia moment. And for a lot of people, Bonesaw McGraw is like this weirdly iconic, you know, I got you for 3 minutes. You know, that whole thing. Yeah. Like they didn't, who is he in 4 minutes of a movie? He like steals scenes where you remember Tom McGraw. I talked to some of the Bonettes who were in the scene with him about him on set. And, you know, he was bringing his Tupperware of chicken and, you know, dialed in on whatever Sam Raimi wanted and showing them how to do the lighting for the wrestling moves. And he was all in. If you do watch or any listening happens to rewatch it, he almost broke his neck in the filming of it. And they actually, the take they used was he was supposed to do an upside down monkey roll off the ropes. And, you know, he's almost 50 at this point and he didn't get it. And if you watch right before he goes, he snaps his neck on the ground. And on the set, they were like, we just lost, not only did we lose Randy, like we might have paralyzed Randy. And he got up and they asked if he could do more takes, and he, you know, being who he was, he kind of gritted through it. And then, you know, he that night from a couple of people on set, and Lanny basically, like, he couldn't move. And he got up. There was only like 3 days. This whole thing was like 3 days of shooting. And he couldn't turn to the left for basically the rest of his life for that. He did 30 takes. But they use the one. If you watch it, and you wouldn't unless you're watching it. If you happen to watch it or even go online after this, you'll see it and you'll just like cringe up. You realize his head just went completely upside down the wrong way. And he's older than us at this point, right? Like he wasn't like a young guy to bounce back from it. But very iconic role. It was really fun to kind of see how that came about. I found some old DVD footage where they would do like, you know, the director's cut where they're interviewing him and he's talking and all that stuff. It's very cool.
What's like the craziest story in the book? Not as far as like craziness, just like nobody would believe it or nobody would know it. Like it's just something that you were like shocked that when you found this piece of material. You don't have to go into the whole story. Obviously we want them to read in the book, but what's like the overview of something like that?
There's a story that a lot of diehard wrestling fans know that I had not heard of, frankly. And people, you know, it happened in territories where Randy got into a brawl with like three police officers and a police dog at a Waffle House after a show. It was like almost a gunfight, definitely a knife fight, but it was a real like, this is going down. One unit came in, a police that tackled him to the ground. He fought them off. Then a canine unit came in, he fought them off, and then they let the dog loose and it bit him in the butt, caused all these problems for him. The line that I have in the story is incredible. I tell the whole scene of this, and I found it from the police report from the day after, and the two or three stories covering it happened at 1:30 in the morning at a Waffle House, like in Kentucky. It's all in the paper, like the next day. So this is all there, you know. Randy, you know, it's like says, you know, like Randy Savage, you know, nay Randy Poffo, who is a wrestler, was arrested. You know, they arrested this and that. But it took three policemen, two billy clubs, and a 110 pound German Shepherd to actually stop a pissed off Macho Man in the middle of the night. who still never ate. He was pissed because the beauty of this story and the details of how it comes about, I really would like you guys to read and hear it. But it all starts because they come in late, he's starving, and right when he's about to order, some regular who worked an overnight shift came in and announced that he had just got engaged. And so all the attention from the waitresses go to this guy to congratulate him. Macho's sitting there getting more pissed by the minute because they're starving. They did a show. They want to eat. Yep. He turns to this guy and says, you know, who gives a bunch of expletives? The guy is not some guy to be messed with. He's like, I'm going to go to my truck and get my gun, buddy. I don't know who you are. Randy stands up. And then the next, like, it's like a 6-page, and it's almost like a comedy, but it's real, but it's also police. And like, the only reason it didn't escalate is because one of the guys had done security at some wrestling shows and he kind of knew Randy as being an absolute lunatic. And so he's like, we just need to let this guy calm down. Anyway, it's a great, great story. I had heard like bits and pieces of the Waffle House story before I started my research. But then when you read the police report and what like the cops on the scene say, it's like, this is the most savage thing that someone named Randy Savage could ever do.
I love that. There's so many awesome Macho Man stories like through the era. I don't know if you had a chance to talk to Marty Jannetty, but he has an awesome, funny story with it's not really Macho Man, but it's Macho Man getting Jannetty and Michaels out of trouble with the cops.
Oh, I didn't hear that one.
Oh, it's very funny, but Jannetty's great at impersonation. So if you ever watch an interview with him, he does the whole thing. So Piper and Mr. Perfect, and he does like their voices, and he's doing like Vince or whatever. He's like, oh, you know, what's going on, pal? And he's doing the whole thing. Piper basically gets Marty and HBK into a fight with each other, which was building anyway because they hate each other from the Rockers. Right. And Macho Man is like the voice of reason and he's got to break it up. But the cops come and the cops basically like, he has to be arrested. And Macho Man, they're like, oh my God, it's Macho Man. They're like, what's going on here? It's a storyline, brother. You know, everyone has their Macho Man. He goes, they're working it out. They're feuding on TV. So as soon as the cop believes Macho Man, they go away. He turns around and Marty goes, what the hell is going on, brother? Like, he had no idea. He just made that up. He had no idea what the hell was going
on. Dude, my favorite thing of doing all these interviews is that everybody who I talk to, and I do it too, is when you tell a story with him, you slip into your own Macho.
Yes.
And my favorite one of all of them was Hacksaw Jim Duggan. We talked for maybe a half hour, and he goes into like, he came up, and when you come up from like a different territory, you kind of only stick with the guys. It's almost like being a college basketball player, football player. Like when you get on a new team, you find the guys who are on your college or in your conference.
Yep.
And so they kind of know each other. So he didn't know Randy at all, but they got along pretty well early. And eventually, like, Randy was not a talker to a lot of people on planes or buses or whatever. He kind of stuck with Liz. And they ended up one night, he said, pretty early in his time, they'd be going to like McDonald's. And he'd only seen him, I'd go in the airport, you know, jeans, t-shirt, but he's got all his gear on, but also doesn't want to be talked to, like a big like dichotomy there. But they go to like a McDonald's at like midnight, and he's like, we walk in, he's like, I'm starving, I'm just gonna get like a Big Mac. And he's like, and I expect, you know, Randy to walk in. We were basically sleeping on the bus, and Randy goes in, he's like, I'll take, you know, take a large fry and two Big Macs, you know. And he's like, Hacksaw's like, what do you, like, you don't have to do this for the 11:30 p.m. like McDonald's work, like cashier, like it's okay if they see you talk. And then he realized like there's no other version at this point. Like he was just like, you're gonna eat those nuggets there, hacker. He called him hacker, which is
crazy. Yeah,
you're gonna eat those nuggets there, hacker. And this is Hacksaw, you know, I'm me now picturing how amazing it would be at, you know, 10 to have Hacksaw Jim Duggan doing a Macho Man at McDonald's impersonation for me. It's like the coolest thing ever.
It's awesome. It is so true. And even people that are like, you know, borderline fans or fringe fans or casuals, even like a buddy of mine that, you know, hasn't watched wrestling forever. If you say Macho Man, oh yeah, like it's like a Pavlovian response. You automatically Macho Man. You just go into
the voice. I've been cutting promos every week for this book as Macho. I got my glasses that I throw on. I got my purple shirt that I throw on. I do a whole like 1 minute, like I did an early one. My favorite Macho line I came up with was, yeah, I was like, before it's a book, it's a Macho Man you script that you got to write. And I was like doing all these things. It's fun. It's a good time.
I always like thinking. I always love that. A cup of tea. Yeah.
So many good ones. He actually early, he has some really good ones against Lawler that I kind of put some little longer excerpts in because people they understand that when he finally got to the WWF, he was pretty well versed in coming up with these things. And he has one where he's like, I'm thinking about your dad, Lawler, and your dad's dead. And he's rolling over in his grave. And he just goes, and you're like, what a lunatic. And then he's just like, Lawler's dead. He's dead. You know, and he's like, you watch him. He's doing the spins, and it's just out of control. But you cannot take your eyes off him, which is why he's so compelling.
And I remember, luckily enough to interview Hogan a few years ago, and I just said, oh, who's your favorite, and he, you know, to work with and stuff. Like, kind of like generic questions. He was like, Andre, Bundy, Stud, Piper, and he goes, and of course, Macho Man. Like, even he couldn't even, like, help himself. He's like, the Macho Man, Randy Savage. Yeah. I can, you know, like, it's just off the cuff. He would just said that in his voice. Like, wow, even Hogan is in love with Macho Man.
They had that nice reconciliation moment towards the end of his life where they, you know, they had been not talking, basically, and then they ran into each other in that. Doctor's Office, where they cover that in one of the documentaries, and Lanny was telling, I was like, is that real? And he's like, it's actually real. What happened was, Randy, all those years on the road, you know, he wasn't around for his parents. He's very close to them, but he wasn't there for the day-to-day. So when he finally retired and moved up near them, you know, he was taking them to their doctor's appointments and stuff all the time. He'd take them, you know, they were old. His parents were in, you know, Judy, I think, was 90-something when she passed away, but they were in their 80s. And he was kind of making up for lost time doing all that stuff. And they ran into each other, and I guess it was nice. And it's a shame when you read the whole arc of the book, it becomes even more of a bit of a loss for the wrestling community, because there was a lot. And again, we're not owed anything, but I think for him too, there was a comeback and a second act as a beloved with Hogan, not wrestling anymore or anything, but a beloved return into the fold. You could kind of, you know, and no one knows. No one's really confirmed. He did that one appearance where he's off the white beard and he's doing the whole thing with the action figures. Yep. But it just felt like there was a long enough distance. We were all, who were all his fans, starting to have our own kids, and we're much more, you know, susceptible to wanting to share Macho with him, not just through YouTube, but, you know, the live version of what he became, kind of like a new icon and in the Hall of Fame, which, and you know, all that kind of stuff. So I think luckily he found personal peace and serenity at that time, getting remarried and all those things. But I think we may have been on a year or two away from like the grand return and Macho doing maybe movies or TV shows, acting. I mean, he was doing voiceovers all over the place for video games and cartoons. And so he was still very much like wanted as a, especially for his voice. But he was very, very talented in a lot of different ways. And I think we could have seen something great out of him, like as a part two to Wrestling Guy. Still would have been Macho Man, still would have been Randy Savage, but he could have played against type in one of those sitcoms. You could just see it. Like, he was just that. He was so magnetic. It would have been something like that.
And people are nowadays even more so obsessed with nostalgia and stuff. So, yes. I mean, that would have been perfect. Anywhere he would have been perfect.
I think so, too. And, you know, as I wrote it, it's like the two big bummers are that Lanny passed away and wasn't able to enjoy this book. And we had, you know, we had talked extensively early on in the writing, and then he passed away about halfway through. You know, I'd gotten the time that I needed to. I had plenty of questions I still could have asked him, of course. But that, him not being able to see it, I dedicate the book to Lanny. And then, yeah, just not having Macho around to, you know, for all of this. I feel like even now, like with everything going on, and, you know, whenever they do something, Tampa, Hogan's back, and whenever they do all these things, they bring the big names in. You know, who knows what him and The Rock? We never got him and The Rock now. Like, it would have been fun. It would have been a lot of fun, or, you know, him riffing off some of these younger guys, or even the Cena era riffing off some of those guys. You know, when he's not a wrestler, he's just doing the character thing. It could have been a good time.
Now, as we hit the wind down, head towards the finish here, what's Macho Man legacy? Like, if you could put it into like a summary, like, what's the legacy of the Macho Man?
I think the legacy of the Macho Man for someone who, if you read it, when you read the book start to finish, is going to be like a complete obsession with perfection of character and performance. And it's very hard to find anyone who had more, because he did it with baseball, ultimately failed, and was able to completely turn and pivot and do it with wrestling. And he just refused to give anything other than everything he had. I mean, this guy is one of those guys who you encounter in any field you're in, and you realize he will not be outworked. It's like Larry Bird. He has that famous, like Larry Bird. And when he talks about that, I laugh, because I grew up in Boston. I'm a big Celtics fan. And Bird famously was the guy who showed up and shot 1,000 shots before anybody, you know, got to the gym and stayed after the games to run around, you know, run and do, you know, another 300 three-pointers and all these things. And you never, there's guys who, if they have the talent and you can't outwork them, they're unstoppable. And Randy refused to be outworked. And there was several times in the book where it just didn't look like it was going to happen for him. You know, the ICW thing, that failed, and then he had a partner with Lawler, like we talked about. But before that, he was also out of wrestling. I mean, they couldn't figure out what to do with him. He was so unique. He had, no real rivalries with anybody. They were trying to save some of these other outfits that didn't work. And there's, these earlier wrestlers that he worked with to try to kind of get things going. But there's maybe three or four times where had things gone differently and had he been a different guy, he just, I'm not saying, I have a line there, he wasn't going to quit and be an accountant, but maybe he does something totally outside of wrestling to make a living.
Now, where can everybody get the book, The Untamed Unbelievable Life of the Macho Man Randy Savage? Where can everybody get
it? It's everywhere. So my website, johnfinkel.com, I have all the links to everywhere. So Amazon, if you get it, if you have an Amazon account, just go there, pre-order it right now. You can follow me at John_Finkel on both Twitter and Instagram. I have a newsletter. It's called Books and Biceps. The link is on anywhere you go to my stuff. That's where I do a ton of giveaways, updates. I do the box reveal when I got the books. There's an awesome Macho Man book trailer. The book trailer is unbelievable. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but the book trailer for Macho, it's like 22 seconds. And every time I see it, it gets me really, really hyped up. So anybody watching this or listening to this, watch the trailer. Pre-order the book. If you do DM me, I have a bunch of awesome hologram stickers of the cover that I can give away. And I have some signed book plates that I can sign to you to give away. So we've got thousands of them. I've already sent. I was joking with my son the other day. He helps me. He's like my little assistant with all this stuff. And we signed 88 book plates on last Friday, and it was our second one. We've had a few with 100. So we've probably sent out over 1,000 already. But the goal is, cream of the crop. We want Macho to be number one. He deserves to be on top. Yeah. It's my book, but it's all of ours. The madness is all of ours. So let's get into the top of the bestseller list.
Yes, I agree. John, thank you so much for all the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. This was awesome.
This has been a John Paz Power Trip production in conjunction with the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Two Man Power Trip. You can check us out on Facebook. You can subscribe on YouTube. You can go to patreon.com/TMPTEmpire to become a patron, and also check out the website TMPTEmpire.com and buy a shirt at ProWrestlingTees.com. Two Man Power Trip, where the power lies, brother.